The time now is 9 o'clock.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Addison Pace. Not only does Utah have a rich history, the state also has a dynamic prehistory. Today on the program, archaeologist Steve Sims discusses Utah's ancient past and what it can reveal about ourselves today. At 9:30, Science Questions presents the modern-day revival of the Civilian Conservation Corp, where programs such as AmeriCorp and the Utah Conservation Corp picked up the torch to carry on its mission of land conservation and job creation. This coming up after the news. Support for Science Questions comes from the College of Science at Utah State University, where students step beyond the classroom participating in advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Sherry Quinn. The past is bigger than we think, says Steve Sims, professor of anthropology at Utah State University. Professor Sims has spent the last several decades researching Utah's ancient history, utilizing archaeology as his scientific method. In his book, Ancient Peoples of the Great Basin and Colorado Plateau, Sims details human occupation starting in the region 13,000 years ago. Archaeologists break it down into four time periods, starting with the earliest, the Paleo-Indian, then the Archaic, the Fremont, and the late Prehistoric. Throughout the book, Sims debunks any preconceived notions of primitive and simple prehistoric bands of people wandering the Western landscape in harmony with nature. Instead, he reveals how America was occupied by cosmopolitan, diverse, and complex societies that were driven by technology just as much as we are driven by technological changes today. And what is it about this landscape that you are so passionate about? If you are, if I can make that assumption, and can you describe the landscape to listeners?
I'm passionate about mountains and deserts, and this is one of the best places in the world for people who like mountains and deserts. The Great Basin is half wet, big mountains, and half dry, harsh deserts. It is, as I suggest in the book, a study in pastels. The colors are muted. Even in prehistoric times, it was often very hazy from dust and fires. These are not just modern things. Fog hung in the valleys in the winter. It wasn't as smoggy as it is today, but it was as foggy as it is today. I like the contrasts, the strong seasons, and I think like other deserts in the world, when I've traveled in them, you always get this sense of the expanse of time, and that is the single strongest lesson that comes out of archaeology. Human affairs on timescales that transcend the lives, motives, intentions of individual people.
The Fremont, were they were small-scale farmers and also foragers? Did they do one more than the other?
Farming is where they got most of their calories, at least the ones who lived in big villages. Now, like today, other Fremont were more rural. Some Fremont were so rural that they seemed to move in and out of these big villages, maybe over the course of their lives. Something that we often don't see or accredit Native American society with, that is the potential for massive changes in lifeway during their life history. We tend to homogenize the past as static. They live all one way. They stay in one place. And what we're finding out through a variety of studies is that that's not the case, that you might be born in a small hamlet of two or three families, and you might die in a village of 300 people. So over the course of your life, your diet would change accordingly. Techniques such as stable carbon isotope, which can track certain types of diet intake, suggest that this is what was happening.
Okay, and the Fremont period is characterized by which time period, 2,000 years ago?
Maize comes to Utah, moves north from Mexico about 100 BC. By AD 500, it's widespread across the state. What I like to say, a sprinkling of farming communities in a sea of foragers. About 1,000 years later, 700 years later, by AD 1100 or so, and then the 12s, there's a lot of people and they're farming. And virtually every town in Utah along Interstate 15 from Brigham City to Cedar City has large Fremont village sites under it, because the Fremont criteria for where they put their villages was exactly the same as what the Mormon pioneers used all those millennia later, because they were both farmers using the water coming out of the mountains.
And is it still a mystery what happened to the Fremont period, and did climate play a role in their abandonment?
Well, everything in science is a mystery. That's the nature of science. It's more about the questions than it is the answers. In the case of the Fremont, when we look beyond the mystery, we find that climate plays a role in two ways. There are repeated large droughts from the mid 1100s on through the late 1200s in a context of massive population growth. They had pretty much done as much as they could with the technology and the farming that they had. They had pretty much filled the landscape. So every time you had one of these droughts, it tended to do two things. It put pressure on them, and it caused them to further intensify and farm places that were even more marginal. It's parallel to what we see today in some environmental problems. By the 1300s, planetary climate in the Northern Hemisphere is changing. We're starting to enter the Little Ice Age. So you take that combination of a culture that's really ramped up and intensifying their economy in response to the stresses, all those droughts, and then the climate starts to cool, and you finally break the system. So the Fremont people persisted, but their culture changed. They could no longer farm the same places, so they had to break up into smaller groups. It looks like many actually emigrated out as far away as Arizona and New Mexico. DNA studies suggest that some Fremont descendants are the Puebloan groups of the upper Rio Grande in northwestern New Mexico today. I think as we get more DNA, we're going to find that all the Fremont didn't leave, and that they were here as new Native American groups arrived in the region, and together they created the next set of cultures. Both immigration and emigration are constant in antiquity. Not only in the demise of the Fremont, you have new people coming in because of some Fremont farmers gave up and moved out. It left a vacuum. People from the West came in, the Shoshone of today. They, together with the remnant Fremont, built a new culture. And here, time-wise, we're talking AD 1300, 1400, 1500. So in one sense, it's that combination of indigenes and immigrants that build a new culture. It's not a question of who is descended from whom. In the broadest sense, they're all related to each other. We tend to put everything into cubbyholes and see them as strictly typological. And that particularly doesn't work for genetics, but it doesn't necessarily work very well for language either. One of the things we know from historic period Native America is that there was quite a bit of multilingualism going on. So you've got people who could potentially grow up speaking several Native American languages. That's what I mean by cosmopolitan. I think once you start looking at the deeper past that way, you're able to draw on the knowledge we have from modern Native Americans and other foraging societies and farming societies around the world to start to get a little richer picture of what ancient Utah was like, beyond what arrowheads they used and what type of houses they lived in and what culture we call them. So when a modern Native American of the region asked me, well, are we related to the Fremont or not? My answer is yes and no, in the same way that I'm related to some of my German ancestors and English ancestors and everybody else in between who has been part of the picture.
So the book, you go through the Paleo-Indian and then the Archaic and then the Fremont. And the Archaic is broken up into early, middle, and late, and Fremont and late prehistoric. And is there a time period more interesting to you that you find more intriguing? Or
I find intriguing things about all the different time periods. And the book starts traditionally with the earliest, called the Paleo-Indian. I call it the first explorers, colonists, and settlers, to signal that this isn't just a matter of people coming here and presto, we've got Indian culture. The fascinating thing about that period to me is that 13,000 plus years ago, when the first people walked into our region, that was the last time that this was a true wilderness, that is, without people. From that moment on, this has been a human wilderness. It took a while, because the very first people in here were small groups of explorers. Some that probably didn't stay, pull back out, as explorers do. Then you get some colonists coming in, and some of those colonial communities failed. The genetics are suggesting some genetic bottlenecks and dead ends. Finally, it starts to take hold, and you get settlers. That's when you're starting to fill the spaces. That's when the foothold has been made. That entire process took between 1,000 and 2,000 years is all, which in archaeological terms isn't that much. But it sure is a lot of time, given how much has happened in our own Western culture, the Judeo-Christian culture, in a mere 2,000 years.
That was Steve Sims, professor of anthropology at Utah State University. I'm Sherry Quinn for Access Utah. In his new book, Ancient Peoples of the Great Basin and Colorado Plateau, Sims exposes a surprisingly wide array of prehistoric tools and strategies for surviving in a harsh desert and mountain environment. What was interesting too in that the single most utilized tool, the wooden digging stick, for roots. And then could you talk about the range of their diet? Because to me that was really interesting. And
well, when we think about the toolkit of hunters and gatherers who live at low densities in arid regions, we think simplicity. That doesn't mean it's not ingenious or that it's dysfunctional. If you took all the items in the Great Basin toolkit, say of a culture 5,000 years ago, it has fewer parts than you'll find in the average dashboard of a car today. But it is perfectly geared to needs and flexible, and sometimes isn't quite what we might think. We often think of, well, they've got to have their spear or bow and arrow. Well, the bow and arrow doesn't even come into the region until AD 500. The dart and atlatl, or dart thrower, was the weapon of choice. But by far and away, the most trustworthy and routinely used tool was the digging stick, because plants dominated the diet. They would try to get large game whenever they could, but large game were scarce, largely because ancient Native Americans kept the large game cropped to such low levels that they were never really abundant. The most commonly eaten meat through all of prehistory in the American Desert West is rabbit, because they were abundant. It was difficult to keep them cropped down. But plants made up the bulk of the calories. And the digging stick is the way you get roots, which were a staple, dozens of different kinds. Plants, too, anchored the clothing. One of the things the artists in this book did was pay very careful attention to clothing, and we made sure that there was it was mostly fiber clothing, woven fiber clothing, sagebrush bark shirts, leggings, pant-like garments made out of woven reeds. I told the artist when we started working on this years ago, I said, I don't want to see any fringed buckskin, because those garments might have existed, maybe without the fringe, but they were not common in the larger scheme of things. This is a stereotype we have from a blink of time in the early 19th century.
Wow.
And it didn't last long then. In fact, probably one of the reasons why it appears in the early 19th century that there was a lot of large game in the American West is because most of the Native Americans had already been had died from European-introduced disease, and the game populations had time to rebound.
When did you first find evidence of consuming grasshoppers, the grasshopper drives? And then I have to ask you about the desert lobster.
In the chapter on the archaic period, I described the situation at Lakeside Cave, which is a cave on the west side of Great Salt Lake, where grasshopper processing was a primary activity there for several thousand years. And for about a five-century run, about 4,500 years ago, it was a very intense activity. The conditions were right with the size of the lake and the winds that masses of grasshoppers would be blown out into the lake and then drift up onto shore dead. And they would form beaches, if you will, windrows of salted, dried, ready-to-eat grasshoppers. They were scooped up along with the oolitic sands, the characteristic sands that border the Great Salt Lake, and brought into the cave. And we even have coprolites, which is the fancy term for dried human feces. There's a picture of one in the book. Bristling with grasshopper exoskeletons. I sampled grasshoppers back in the early 1980s when I was an adventurous graduate student with two of my graduate student colleagues who had done a lot of work with foragers in South America. And living with hunter-gatherers, you learn to eat anything. And so they said, well, let's catch some of these things and eat them. So we drove them into a pit where we lit the pit on fire, brush, and picked out the roasted grasshoppers, pull the legs off and the head, and I'll be darned if that little strip of white meat down their back didn't taste like shellfish, hence the moniker desert lobster. I've had a few brave students since take me up on the challenge to eat them, and most are surprised that they're pretty good. Huh. But insects are eaten in many cultures all over the world, and they were very commonly eaten in the Great Basin, where they were one of the ingredients to the original power bar or energy bar of today. We call it desert fruitcake around here. On the plains, they call it pemmican.
Another significant change in what you refer to in the book, the term was coined by Jesse Jennings, the twin hallmarks of the desert culture. What significant changes they brought about, and how much they changed the way of life.
Yeah, the twin hallmarks is a term coined by the very famous Utah archaeologist Jesse D. Jennings. And he's referring to the milling stone and coiled basketry. They both appear in the archaeological record for a round figure about 9,000 years ago. And like all technology, it's not so much the invention that enables the behavior. It's the opposite. That technology arose because of massive and fundamental changes in the culture. What had happened is the Paleo-Indian explorers, colonists, and settlers had come in and skimmed the cream off the wilderness. Now they were starting to exploit all the foods that the desert had to offer, and many of them were hard, small seeds. Paleo-Indians had eaten grass seeds, making flour out of them. But until about 9,000 years ago, at the dawn of the period we call the Archaic, those small seeds had not played a major role in the diet. But there was no way to support the population that they had by just eating bighorn sheep and mule deer and rabbit and even the cheaper plants to take. So they were starting to add items to the food economy that were more and more expensive. And the most expensive of all are small, hard seeds. The advantage that they gave was that they're storable. They could put them away for winter. But in order to prepare them, they had to grind them up, and they had to process them, winnow the chaff and all this. It's one thing to do this casually. It's one thing, for instance, to buy a bag of sunflower seeds and you shell them and eat them one by one. But if you want to live on sunflower seeds, you're going to have to find a way to mass produce them. That's what the grinding stone and the coil basketry did. The grinding stone for making them digestible, and the coil baskets were so tight they could hold water. So you could process extremely small seeds, which the earlier twine basketry was not able to process because the seeds would fall through the holes in the basket. So hence the twin hallmarks. It's a life-driving technology, just like today. I often get asked about the pinyon pine because it was a major staple of the Shoshonean tribes of the Great Basin during the historic period. In fact, the Paiute Wars in central Nevada in the 1860s were in part because of mining, white Euro-American mining interests cutting down the forests and taking the pinyon pine, the staple. Interestingly, the Native Americans who lived in central Nevada 6,000-8,000 years ago did not eat very many pinyon nuts because the pinyon pine had not yet arrived to the range that it occurs in today. And it's a good example of how we can't simply take the life of Native Americans now or in the last century or even two or three centuries and simply apply it uncritically onto the deep past. There's too much time. And so if we have an image of what Indians did from history and we homogenize the past, we've missed most of it. And the pinyon pine's a good example. The economy did not hinge around the pinyon pine in those earlier millennia. That's a fairly recent phenomenon. In central Nevada, it's about 5,000 years old. In western Nevada, it's only about 1,000 years old. So it's a good example of the lesson of time. After all, people have been living in Utah for over 13,000 years. That's over 430 human generations. Nobody has a genealogy even approaching that. Archaeology is the only way you'll get at that.
That was Steve Sims, professor of anthropology at Utah State University and author of Ancient Peoples of the Great Basin and Colorado Plateau. For Access Utah, I'm Sherry Quinn. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. I'm Megan Van Frank. The Old Hotel Utah has a storied history of hospitality that is shadowed by the racial prejudice common throughout Utah right into the 1960s. Learn more after this.
The Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by the Utah Humanities Council, with support from a We the People grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation.
Located on South Temple and Main Street in downtown Salt Lake City, the venerated Hotel Utah was known in its day as the Great White Palace. It hosted heads of state, United States presidents, and Hollywood greats. Yet when the internationally celebrated opera singer Marian Anderson made a concert stop in Utah in 1937, she couldn't find a hotel room. Anderson was African American. When she returned a year later, the Hotel Utah relented, as long as she used the freight elevator and didn't eat in the public dining room. Anderson's experience was one of many Utah examples of racial discrimination that also included other noted entertainers. Paul Robeson, Harry Belafonte, Ella Fitzgerald, and Lionel Hampton were all directed to the back elevator and ate meals in their rooms. In 1954, Frontier Magazine compared discrimination in Utah, Nevada, and Arizona with the American South. This was despite a 1948 Utah law making it a misdemeanor to refuse service to blacks. During this time, Utah Realtors attempted, but failed, to create segregated neighborhoods in Salt Lake and Ogden. In 1955, Marion Mills, an African-American military veteran, wrote to the Salt Lake Tribune complaining that blacks were required to occupy balcony seats in many local theaters and that certain jobs in Salt Lake were unavailable to blacks, as were most nightclubs and bars. Mills could have also mentioned that hospitals restricted black patients to private rooms and kept separate the plasma of blacks and whites in their blood banks. Utah passed even stricter laws against interracial marriages during the 1950s. When these laws were repealed in 1963, the state barely beat out Wyoming, the last Western state to abandon its interracial marriage laws. The African-American population in the Beehive State has grown markedly since then, and the days of the Great White Palace are gone, in more ways than one. But is Utah truly free from discrimination? Research and writing for this episode of the Beehive Archive were provided by Rebecca Anderson. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.
Support for Science Questions is provided by Apogee Instruments of Cache Valley, creating innovative sensors for measuring climate change, sustainable food production, and renewable energy. More information is at apogeeinstruments.com.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Susie Montgomery.
And I am Sherry Quinn.
It is not unusual to see groups of seniors in St. George, Utah. But how about seeing a group of the first conservationists of the United States of America, averaging 90 years old and passing the conservation torch to the younger generations? These men are the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, who built most of our nation's trails, dams, and bridges during the Depression era. Of the roughly 20,000 men who comprised the Corps from 1933 to 1938, about 1,000 are still living, and a dozen made their way across the nation to attend a CCC legacy gathering where they toured their old camps.
I spent 18 months in one camp, and I got out, and there was still no work around. So I went back in, went to a camp in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and they were just about ready to close, and they shipped us all up into North Adams, Mass. But it was a great experience. And if the kids could do it today, good luck to them.
We caught up with some of those kids in St. George.
Once in a while, we have people who come through and realize, you know what, I never want to work this hard again in my life. And then they go and they get a job in a bank. And I think that's a good thing, actually, because sometimes we want to help those people decide that this is not for them.
That was Dave Bastian, the program coordinator for a modern-day conservation corps, the Utah Conservation Corps, or UCC, based at the Utah State University campus in Logan. UCC is a branch of AmeriCorps, a federal government agency created under President Bill Clinton that focuses on education and the maintenance of public lands. And these young men and women are workhorses of conservation.
My name is Adam Stodel. I'm the roving field boss for the Utah Conservation Corps.
Stodel, who works with Bastian, describes his work much the same as old-timer Charlie Wallmeyer's, but with a different motivation.
You know, I feel that conservation was in its infancy with Roosevelt and the Civilian Conservation Corps. You know, they had an interesting way of looking at things, and they were starting to get into some of the soil conservations, erosion control, but a lot of it was trying to get recreation to happen on our natural lands, on our public lands. And so building of reservoirs, building of dams, improving the ability for us, you know, to have agriculture. I feel like conservation then was trying to mold the environment to a way that humans could interact in it in an easier fashion. Now we're just trying to mold our activities so that we can interact with the natural environment easier. So I think that's kind of the major shift. I feel that the heart has always been the same, but the techniques have molded as science and as kind of the sustainable mentality has caught up with us.
It was a typical banquet room, but these men in their 80s and 90s made it lively, swapping stories about their time in the camps, elicited by the speaker of the night, Robert Aldrich, author and CCC historian, who shared similar experiences as a Grand Canyon Park ranger.
A lot of our infrastructure, our water lines, our sewer lines, our industrial buildings were done by the CCC in the 30s. Here's the basics. Got to be between 17 and 25. You got to be from a poor family. You have to be a citizen, no prison record. Have to be in good health, no communicable diseases. Basic things like that. You take an oath that's less than a page long, and you got guaranteed work for 6 months and the ability, perhaps, to learn some new skills to put you back to work.
91-year-old Fred Garcia from Glendale, Arizona, joined the CCC, just a boy looking for a job.
I was just getting out of high school, 6 months. I got out of high school in June of 37, no jobs, nothing to do, and it was a chance to do something, also help out the family, because $25 a month was sent to directly to your family, so that was roughly equivalent of a week's wages for my father. So in other words, getting an extra payday a month.
Many historians say that the Great Depression was one of the greatest crises to hit our country since the Civil War. Over 100,000 businesses had failed. Over 5,000 banks had failed. Unemployment was 25%. Now we have a new president. His name is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Conservation is a favorite thing for him. He had done conservation on his estate in New York. As governor of the state of New York, he had pushed through a bill to put young men to work in state parks and things like that.
Within 2 years, Roosevelt had orchestrated basically a conservation army of over 500,000 men working in thousands of locations across the U.S. Together, the men cleared 28,000 miles of trails, planted 3 billion trees, built 63,000 buildings, created 800 new state parks still in use today, and constructed 125,000 roads.
Getting used to working with your hands, and especially, it was a toughening up process. I mean, I'm standing in a ditch 7 feet deep, and it's maybe 4 feet wide, and I've got a long-handled shovel, and I'm trying to throw dirt out the top. And that and splitting rocks and so forth. You develop a certain amount of muscle. You usually ended up with one fellow that you sort of buddied around with, and you got along with everybody else. That was one of the things that taught you was how to work and how to get along with people. Look at it this way. Everybody was in the same boat you were. So you weren't exceptional in any way. So it was just a question of getting on.
Fred had a very interesting life in the sense that he went through the CCC. He stayed kind of locally with the CCC, Philadelphia to Virginia. But after that, once he went into the Air Force, he spent 31 years abroad, 31 years living in Europe, living in Africa, working for RCA.
Adam Stodel of the Utah Conservation Corps and Fred Garcia spent the day together comparing notes.
I've been concentrating on conservation corps in the Intermountain West and just thinking about taking that concentration and broadening it out to an area that has a similar climate but may not have a similar conservation mind or may not have that set up with any kind of national preserves or land beautification projects or anything like that in other countries, and taking that abroad. And so I think that international scope is something that I learned from him today, and the fact that you can really just go into anything. He was a mechanic and then got into the Air Force, and the Air Force said that he failed his mechanical aptitude test. And he'd been an auto mechanic for 10 years. And so, it's one of those things where he went into communications. And from that point on, he had his lifelong career. And so it was just kind of random by chance. And he ended up traveling around the world and passing on his knowledge around the world. And I think I'd like to do something similar.
The fact is that Adam might have to diversify sooner than later. UCC accepts only a quarter of the hundreds of applications they get a year. This speaks to the desire of young people who want to get involved in preserving our natural environment. Adam has a job now, but if AmeriCorps gets axed, some people in Congress want to cut it completely right now. UCC would lose 40% of its funding, and America would be passing up a really good deal.
AmeriCorps in the state of Utah is teaching young people to read. It's providing medical services for individuals on the Navajo Nation who have no other access to medical services. It's essentially working with folks like us who are providing both training and work for public lands. And it's doing it in an incredibly economical way.
The director of UCC, Sean DeMitz, in Logan, reports that Corps volunteers generate 15.3 million hours of work and save the government an estimated value of $327 million per year. This core network specializes in preparing youth with on-the-job skills, valuable to our future workforce. Many young people are attracted to this kind of work. According to the UCC, there are three main reasons why they gravitate to agencies like AmeriCorps and UCC. One, they are passionate about the environment and want to give back. Two, they want a career in public land management and get their foot in the door. And three, they are driven by a romantic notion of the West, having just read Desert Solitaire or Kerouac. They are ready for an adventure. Whatever the reason, modern-day corps are approaching conservation genuinely, and they are the laborers keeping our public lands in shape.
People don't realize that there are conservation corps still today, and that we're still doing that same kind of work. You know, building trails, building fence, doing habitat restoration, all, and it's taking place all over the country. So I'm pretty sure that even though every state doesn't have a corps, there's a corps operating in nearly every state in the country, if not every state in the country. But I do think that, by and large, a lot of folks are not aware of that fact. We'd all love to see that change, I think.
Like Dave Bastian, John Irish is dedicated to the legacy of the CCC. He is founder of the Coquina Rural Environment Corps in Flagstaff, Arizona, and very involved in today's youth corps. He adds they are integral to keeping many rural communities alive.
People come to these remote areas of small towns, of little villages around the country that are in these, in and around the national forests and national parks to recreate. When they come, they spend their money in the local restaurants, the gas stations, bait shops, all of those places. And what really keeps that industry going are good trails to hike on, scenic parks, well-maintained parks. And so a lot of what these corps do really are rural development, local infrastructure, maintenance and construction.
Okay, welcome to Southern Utah.
That is Marian Jacqueline, who goes by the nickname Omar. She's an archaeologist and the Heritage Program Manager for the Dixie National Forest.
Tour guide Ken Baldridge, one of the organizers of the CCC Legacy Gathering, an MC on the bus, guided us through the CCC camps in the St. George area with impeccable detail while sporting a 10-gallon cowboy hat.
Let me explain about the camp itself. This is one of the later camps. It actually began in October of 1939. It was one of the last camps to close down. It didn't close down until May of 1942, and the property was turned over to the Army. And one of their first jobs was to build a half-mile road, paved road, connecting the camp with the pavement of the roads in Hurricane. This was DG 160, and it was a 5th Corps area camp. Most of the boys were from Ohio, some from Kentucky, some from Indiana, even two from Mississippi. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how they got in here, but that was the makeup of the camp.
What his beef was with Mississippi, we'll never know. The bus was full of CCC men and their sons and daughters. The men were stationed from 6 months to 2 years at any given camp. But it was obvious, this short assignment, but an impact, that its effects lasted generations.
My name is Kathleen Duxbury Yaw, and I am from Ridgewood, New Jersey. I am a CCC baby. My father was George Duxbury, and he volunteered for 4 enrollments. Starting in 1937, he was a orphan from New York City. He was from Brooklyn. And he went into the CCC, and it gave him stability, and he was forever grateful. He was the only son of an only son. And by 1937, everyone was dead. They were all deceased. And if you were on, you know, if you were 17, 18 in 1937, at the height of the Depression, you were on your own. He was on his own. So it, and he would spoke of it as the happiest period in his youth, and it prepared him well. He had a garden all his life ever since, so he was very happy because of it. He had 3 photo albums, and several years ago I came across the photo albums, and I do have vivid memories of him telling me of the happy times, but of course I never understood it. I was too young, or maybe I was just too thick.
Duxbury started researching the CCC and discovered the government had hired a very select group of artists to make a pictorial record of what the C's were accomplishing at the camps.
this has changed actually my life and that of my husband, Gardner, who retired last year. We are traveling in a 1983 vintage Wander Lodge bus by the Bluebird Bus Company. And we're traveling, which allows us to stay in state and national parks, which is where the CCC boys are. And we've been told that Ralph Cramden would be very comfortable at the wheel of this bus. It's that old.
Ralph Cramden, played by actor Jackie Gleason, was a short-tempered bus driver on a 1950 sitcom, The Honeymooners. We asked how and if the Wander Lodge was holding up.
Oh, no. No, it's constant problem. You know, my husband likens the bus to a house on wheels that experiences multiple earthquakes every day. Something is always shaking loose. I mean, there's always something. We pull behind us a Jeep, a 1995 Jeep that my husband refers to as his little red toolbox.
Kathleen and her husband started their investigations in their home state, New Jersey, and are visiting CCC camps across the country, where these artists are known to have worked.
We're looking for the art, the artists, and the story. Roosevelt did not call them unemployed. He did not call them relief. He referred to them as idle artists, and that is the title of my research, Idle Artists of the Great Depression, a pictorial record of the Civilian Conservation Corps. I'm absolutely humbled just by the CCC in general. It was a remarkable program. I mean, just the boys that we're with today, my father, I mean, people say they saved America. I believe they did. I believe America was a country that was blowing and floating away, certainly in the Great Depression. And the artists themselves, it's remarkable.
Many of the sites of the old camps we visited are now golf courses and housing developments. The physical record has long been washed away, and only stories and memories are left. What Joan Sharp, the president of the Civilian Conservation Corps legacy, is dedicated to preserving, in order to pass the conservation torch onto younger generations.
They and their heritage now depend on us, because they believe that the CCC story changed their life. And of course, as an organization, the Civilian Conservation Corps legacy, it's our job to make sure that the history of the CCC isn't forgotten. And part of that is to reach out to corps like the Utah Conservation Corps to make sure that people know about it. You know, there is not a lot of people that understand that there is a modern corps system out there. I sit at my desk every day and somebody will call and say they need another corps. You know, if you would read the paper, if you would pay attention to what's being said in the news and things, you would know that there is a lot of really good kids out there working in conservation, and it's already here. The question is, how do we tell that story to the American public? How do we tell it to our legislators? How do we let America know that it's already happening?
Dave Bastian agrees. Most of the work they do remains under the radar. They are often pulling 60-hour weeks, carrying heavy equipment deep into wilderness study areas, teaching and training young people hard skills, and instilling a sense of obligation to conservation and preservation of America's pristine wilderness.
We take young folks from all over the country and we put them to work on public lands, what I describe as the most beautiful public lands in America. And we work for nearly every national park in the state. We work for all the federal agencies, Forest Service, BLM, National Park Service. We work for municipalities such as Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County. We cover, and then we actually also get a little bit into Idaho, Wyoming, and Arizona a bit.
Bastian's colleague, Nicole Ashton, is a field boss for the UCC. She symbolizes the essence of the difference between the old CCC and the modern day Corps.
I've always kind of been involved in man's work. Learning a lot of new skills and being able to dive in right in there with the guys, you know, learn how to run a chainsaw and then helped with the training this fall with the chainsaw and stuff. And it's always really fun to surprise the guys with what we're capable of doing. Just the other week, we had some 80-pound bags of cement that we needed to move down the hill, and one of the crew leaders had said to me, well, we'll get somebody to help you with those bags. And when he came back, I was, you know, carrying them over my shoulder, like, down the hill. And he was like, I'm sorry that I said that we would get help for you. Obviously, you didn't need it. And I was just like, yeah. And it's empowering for me to, you know, have these different doors open to me or to girls to see, you know, you can do this.
One of the biggest things I get out of being in this position with the Utah Conservation Corps is seeing those aha moments in my Corps members when they really develop not just the ability to conduct a new skill, but the confidence in themselves that's developed by obtaining those new skills. So it's the hardest, but also the most rewarding.
That was Adam Trenzo, a UCC field boss in Moab. It is this sense of pride in the old and the young that has cultivated guardians of America's lands across the 20th and 21st centuries. It is a lifestyle that isn't for the weary.
My name, Richard B. Kreisinger. My birthday, 2 July, 1922. One of the main things that taught me was discipline and how to become a leader. I'll be 90 in my next birthday. I served in 3 base camps, 1 spike camp, and 1 district headquarters. First base camp was Camp Rusk, Company 3652, Rusk County, Wisconsin. I spent 6 months there in the heart of winter. Cold, 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 being a young boy of 14.
Richard's grandmother forged papers in order for him to enroll in the CCC at the age of 15, pretending he was 18. The CCC boys made $30 a month, and 25 of that was automatically sent home to their families. Estranged from his father and on the move, the CCC was a refuge from train hopping and homelessness for Richard that started when he was only 14.
My parents were divorced, and I had problems with my mother, and during the divorce proceedings, my father used the wrong psychology on me. So I was a high school dropout in my freshman year. I rode the rods across the United States. I was a young hobo at the age of 14.
Well, Mac, the Viper said I've been in the mooch. I'm tired of you smoking and all my hoots. Gonna take my raise, they're gonna give you the goose.
Richard's service in the CCC Corps changed his track, and he went on to serve the country in 3 major wars: World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam. The CCC gave young men hope and discipline, transforming a trail-hopping hobo into a decorous soldier.
Bunch of country and city kids with no work, families near starving, are going to get paid $30 a month and send 25 home to their families. They're going to join this corps and fix up forests and mountains and roads and dams and all sorts of things. And yes, the government is paying for that. You mean it's like the army? Shouted Zeke. Well, the war fellows are handling it with rules and disciplines, but it's called the Civilian Conservation Corps, shouted another voice.
That was Judith Edwards, actress and author of Invasion on the Mountain, The Adventures of Will Ryan and the Civilian Conservation Corps, the first in a 3-part series. The story is about a boy who gets involved with the CCC and takes place on Scutney Mountain. And near the mountain is a small town where Judy currently lives, and also home to one of the first CCC camps in the United States. The CCC activity on the mountain helps the young boy and gives him purpose, during a time where jobs were scarce and people were depressed. And in reality, the CCC Public Relief Program gave purpose to tens of thousands of young men. It was a divisive decision by Roosevelt to pour taxpayers' money into unskilled manual labor jobs, boosting the economy.
I think that's one of the reasons I've gotten so involved with the Civilian Conservation Corps and why I'm in Utah at the moment. My family were very Republican. I am very Democrat. And they were ranchers in Colorado. And so when the WPA gave all these people money, my family, who, when the ranch didn't work, they'd go and work in the steel mills, got very upset and became Republicans. They had been Democrats. And they moved to California. So growing up, the worst word in the world was Roosevelt, said that way. It's a little hard for me to say Roosevelt, which is the way you're supposed to say it. So I don't think we could ever repeat the CCC in the first place. Can you see a president getting in there on getting elected March 4th, and then by March 31, the Civilian Conservation Corps existed because he'd gotten the Congress involved. He'd suggested the idea. The Congress got involved. The cabinet approved. The Congress got involved. The Congress voted for it. The vote was, the bill was passed, and it started.
America is facing the same decisions today. Do we cut AmeriCorps in tough times, or do we pull a Roosevelt? Certainly the old boys of the CCC are a living legacy of the benefits of building up our youth and of putting our energies into conservation and the mentality of conservation. The fruits of their labor, their blood, sweat, and tears, are the roads we all travel. This May, a partnership between the Utah Conservation Corps, U.S. Forest Service, the Wasatch Water Legacy, and Salt Lake City Department of Public Services were awarded $95,000 in funding to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to increase youth participation in UCC's Bilingual Youth Corps program. The funding will establish a new program in Salt Lake City. Emmy Melotis is director of Salt Lake City Parks and Public Lands.
So essentially, Salt Lake City, in partnership with our Wasatch Front regional partners and the Utah Conservation Corps, applied for a grant to initiate a bilingual youth corps here in Salt Lake City area. We are really excited because we were able to partner funds from our open space program to kick this off.
The beginning of this bilingual youth corps down in Salt Lake City is really an initiation of getting youth involved in conservation efforts, specifically in the urban-wildland interface, which is really important to kind of ongoing stewardship efforts of our bigger public lands that are farther off from the city. This will be an opportunity for kids to connect with nature and conservation efforts in their own hometown.
Leslie Chan is the Open Space Lands Program Manager of Salt Lake City.
These kids will be working alongside adult Utah Conservation Corps members and my staff to continue on with these projects. We're going to be doing trail improvements and habitat restoration in several areas, including Wasatch Hollow Open Space and Parley's Historic Nature Park, along with the Jordan River.
I think the idea is yes, you can be a park ranger, you know, out in an amazing wilderness somewhere, but you can also be engaged in these things here in Salt Lake City.
The Utah Conservation Corps, a legacy of the CCC, was established under the umbrella of AmeriCorps, whose mission is to create employment and preserve lands. Emily and Leslie explain how the UCC model benefits our community.
The Corps has provided Americans some amazing services over the generations during different periods of our history. We have amazing architectural features in our national parks as a result of, you know, the services and the hard work that that was provided, also while providing employment opportunities. And so similarly, Salt Lake City is excited about this opportunity for partnership because we see that youth are underemployed. We understand that having a strong, robust economy helps a community thrive and improves everybody's quality of life, which is really what we want for our citizens. And so when we preserve parks, when we preserve open space, and when we maintain them properly, it's just contributing to that holistic benefit that we all come to reside in this area for. Furthermore, I think the mission of Utah Conservation Corps of actually doing the work and providing the skills is something that we want in-house because, you know, not only do we want to make sure that staff that are coming to Leslie maybe to work in her program in the future understand the challenges, because, you know, as our communities grow, it's our open spaces, our developed parks and natural lands that receive a lot of pressure because we all want to be there. And so land management is a really important skill set that we need our youth to be able to be trained in so that as future pressures increase, we're able to meet the public's needs.
The other great thing about the Utah Conservation Corps is that they really bring a regional and kind of a statewide perspective to this work. whereas these youth will get an experience in the city. Being connected to the Utah Conservation Corps kind of gives this larger perspective, which is something that we definitely want to have taught to the youth as well, or have them feel that connection to the bigger state perspective.
The grant will fund 4 separate 5-week sessions in Salt Lake City starting this summer. Youth members are expected to complete 50 miles of urban open space trail maintenance and habitat restoration on 135 acres of public land.
I would encourage that if you see the youth out in the field working in any of our parks, they'll be in uniform, so they'll be very recognizable. I'd encourage you to thank them and to give them support. We did have some folks last summer acknowledge the Utah Conservation Corps' efforts in some of our parks, and I think one day somebody brought them some ice cream shakes, which was really sweet, because they are on the front lines of implementing projects for us, which oftentimes have inherent challenges or controversies because we have many user groups and sometimes uses are mutually exclusive and there are some tensions that arise. And I think for as much as we work with the public to get to a resolution and have an implemented or adopted management plan supported by the mayor and council, when we have these young people implementing the visions that the city stands behind, it's important to not take out one's perspective or disappointment on somebody who's really providing public service. So I'd encourage supporting the folks that you see out there working in the field.
Youth interested in participating in the Utah Conservation Corps program can sign up at usu.edu/UCC or call 435-797-0964. The application deadline for the first session is June 4th. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. Thank you for listening.